This is Radio West. I'm Doug Fabrizio. On November 8th of 2018, a wildfire took hold just east of the town of Paradise in the Sierra Nevada foothills in Northern California. Lucy Walker's documentary, premiering at Sundance this year, captures those first hours. It's a collection of phone videos and news coverage and 911 calls. And this takes up the first 30 minutes or so of the film, and it is intense and dramatic and legitimately terrifying. Walker captures that moment in the story when everything turns from just another fire in the foothills to a disaster. And when it was over, 85 people were dead, 19,000 structures burned to the ground, 50,000 were displaced. It's called the Camp Fire, and it was the most destructive and deadly wildfire in California's history, the most expensive natural disaster in the world. But on that same day, November 8th, there were four massive fires raging through California. And Walker's film shows people picking through the ashes of their homes. She says when a fire burns everything away, it reveals things like what you value and where you fit in the social order. The film also reveals the decisions made in the American West about forest and land ecology and the story we've all told ourselves that fire is a villain rather than part of a natural process. Today in the program, we're beginning our coverage of this year's Sundance Film Festival with Lucy Walker's film. It's called Bring Your Own Brigade. We'll give you details about seeing the film. All of the Sundance selections are online this year. Lucy Walker has produced a few films that have premiered at Sundance. They include Wasteland and Devil's Playground. And she told us she had an obsession with wildfire, and it began when she first moved to Southern California.
I'd lived in New York before, and before that I'd lived in London, but those places don't have fires, you know. I joke in the film that the last big fire we had in London was the Great Fire of London, which was 1666, and we've solved urban fires. So I just sort of couldn't believe that fire was sort of burning out of control on hillsides that you could see from Los Angeles when I moved to Los Angeles, and I found it very frightening. I didn't want to drive down a highway with a fire on the hillside. I felt very scared by fire. And very confused about what was different about this place. And it was kind of a clue. It was just a sign to me that this landscape was different than the one that I knew. Yeah. And I thought, oh my gosh, it's not enough to look at one fire. We've got to get to the bottom of this because this problem is huge and growing and kind of complicated. And nobody else has really gotten into it. And documentaries are great, as you know, for getting into subjects and really finding the personal journeys that really illuminate a subject, but in a really riveting kind of a way. You know, I really aspire for my films to be very, very engaging and rewarding sort of movie experiences, as well as very illuminating of the world that, you know, we're shining a light into.
Yeah, you describe it, I think, at one point or maybe other points as a study. Like the film is not just a journey, but it's this study of this question you're getting at. And you describe it as you're seeing how these clues are starting to emerge and that your expectations, your ideas about wildfires in the world started to change. So back up before they start to change and talk about when you began this study, what were your expectations? What were your ideas that you figured this was about climate change, I guess, mostly.
Yeah. My expectations were that it was all about climate change and that this was the issue that was driving it. And I could make a film about how climate change was already impacting us here, right in our own backyards. We didn't need to look further afield. The hillside was on fire, and we could look up and we could, with our own noses, with our own eyes, with our own senses, we could experience the climate change that was happening in our very own environment, our very own landscape, our very own community. And that was sort of the thing going in, I thought, that I find. And that didn't turn out to be what I discovered, which was really interesting. So I was forced to change my mind and enlarge my perspective. And this film was very much about that. I had a mission to get to the bottom of wildfire, and I felt very accountable to take that journey where it would lead me. And in fulfilling that ambition, I really wound up in a different place than I began.
Yeah. We have to talk about that first 30 or so minutes of the film, because you're documenting the moments that the Woolsey Fire and the Camp Fire of November 8th really starts to take hold, because these scenes and these moments are gripping and they're intense. Talk about what you wanted from this part of the film, because you draw people in immediately with that. Talk about how you wanted to put it together, because it sets the stage, but it also really brings you into this moment.
Yeah, that's exactly right. I wanted to bring people in. And of course, these days with Facebook Live and cell phones, there's an enormous amount of personal documentary video and audio that's very intense. What we also did was to go through all the 911 recordings. They release all the emergency radio traffic as well as phone calls from that day. And you're listening to extremely frightening scenes of people in enormous terror and peril. So the decision to create a sequence that really took the audience through what it was like that day was a big one, because it's tremendously distressing. Mm-hmm. But I felt that you had to understand how the fire actually worked, and every detail that we chose to put in is actually really thought through and sort of pays off later in the investigation. You need to know how fast the fire went and how it moved and how the houses caught fire and how the emergency preparedness broke down and how the residents responded. And all the little details are really revealing. And so that when the investigation sort of part happens, when we follow first responders and residents through the fire and then through the next over a year. Mm-hmm. And you can see how these stories unfold. And I think that you get the best picture, I hope, ever, of what it's like and what actually goes on and therefore what we can actually do about it.
Yeah, I wanted to ask you about that, because there's the intense part, right? There's the part that the fire is moving fast. So there's that for sure. Mm-hmm. But then there's the other part of this, at least for me, there's an intimacy to it. As people start to realize, not only are they going to lose their houses and their property, but there's this real sense, like very real sense, they could die. Mm-hmm. And so how are you thinking about revealing those moments? Because I'm sure there's the part of you that wants to be, of course, really sensitive, the idea that this could trigger people who are seeing it. But you also felt like it's almost revealing those, you know, the last words in those black box recorders when a plane goes down. I mean, there's this gut-wrenching, it's a supremely private moment. So how are you thinking about what you should reveal, what you should show, what you should maybe back off on a little bit? I mean, because this was a really powerful part of the film.
Yeah, there was material we chose not to show. There were some videos that we felt were snuff videos, the wrong word, but it sort of...
Yeah, I know what you mean, though. Yeah.
They exist on YouTube, and we chose not to include them. Everything that we put in, we felt was helpful for people to understand, including the fact that an enormous amount of people really thought that they were about to die. You also get the heroics. We chose to include one story, for example, of a guy that saved over 100 people. Dozer driver. But we chose to include those stories because they really, I think, help you understand what the firefighters and first responders are doing, which is saving so many lives. Yeah. And also that some people didn't make it.
Yeah.
And it is important that we realize that 88 people died that day in those two incidents, but a lot of people also died following, including one of the people we spoke to, of the stress with heart attacks and various smoke inhalation. And they don't count those injuries in the death tolls. So 88 is just the people whose remains were recovered. They're not the people who died in the hospital of burns, et cetera. And it's interesting that you never get those statistics. And I think it's important that we understand that, because it's going to happen more, and it could happen in more populated areas. Mm. So the film, I think, really wanted to take the audience into, again, just that simple thing of what is it like to be in the shoes of the first responders? What is it like to be in the shoes of the residents? And another actual assumption that I had was that everyone would evacuate, because I'm a chicken. And I couldn't understand that people were staying to fight the fires to protect their homes. This seemed completely bonkers to me.
That gets us to, maybe this is not exactly right, but kind of part of the heart of it are the people directly affected by fires, the homeowners. Mm-hmm. And one in particular I saw as a kind of through line for the film, And we keep coming back to him, is Brad Weldon. Tell us a little bit about him. He's lived in, I guess, paradise or in that area anyway most of his life. He's a free spirit, cares for his elderly mother. Talk a little bit about finding him. He's one who stayed behind to fight the fire with a garden hose.
He is the luckiest guy alive.
Yeah.
It is astonishing that he's alive. Yeah, he stayed to fight with a garden hose because he'd built the house for his late wife, and his blind mom was 90 and lived on the couch in the house. And he has been through several fires. His mom had lost their home, and then he'd lost his house twice as a kid and twice as an adult, which is again a kind of clue for me. It's like, gosh, yeah, these fires happen a lot. Like,
yeah,
I had no idea you could live in a place that burns your house down five times in the course of a lifetime. And he's not an old guy, you know, was astonishing to me. And he didn't want to go. And yet a lot of people who stayed to defend in paradise were killed. He's the only lucky one who stayed and successfully defended his home that day in the town of Paradise. The whole town was wiped out, 90% of the structures destroyed. And yet he successfully defended the home, and he claims that the wind, you know, changed, and he credits the angels of his dead wife actually for taking care of the property. And certainly someone was looking out for him that day. His luck was stupendous, and he lived to tell the tale. And it's an interesting place as well, Paradise. You know, I am from London, went to grad school in New York, now I live in Los Angeles. So I've lived in these urban, cosmopolitan, liberal, democratic leaning kind of places, and have all my educated friends. And one thing that was really wonderful for me actually was to get out of my own bubble. And to start with, of course, you're just talking about fires and meeting as human beings. But this comes a certain point, and it came as a bit of a shock to me. I didn't quite understand that I was how far out of my own bubble I was until kind of the issue of climate change and politics started coming up. And I thought, oh my gosh, this is not the people I'm used to talking to.
Yeah. So you explore a lot of elements in the story. And in one section of the film, which you place really right in the aftermath of that terrifying day and these days of recovery that are coming, people are still really trying to figure out what's going to happen in their lives. But you find that some of the people who you figured were going to connect what had happened, at least in part, to what you figured, which was climate change, but they weren't. And you described that as a shock. Talk about this.
Yeah, I had a couple of moments where people are telling me that climate change is a hoax. And you're talking to somebody, and there's one wonderful moment which is captured in the film where a guy is chatting to me about how climate change is a hoax. And then he suddenly realizes that I'm not on the same page as him. And he turns around and says, are you from New York? And I'm thinking, how do you handle this? You know, we live in this moment that is so much about political division, right? And people are falling out with their relatives over politics. People are more divided than ever before. People are listening to their different news feeds and really losing touch with the middle ground or the opposing arguments. And so I think that was really wonderful in this moment of division to go outside my own bubble and meet people quite different from me and think they are wonderful and we are friends. You know, if the more we're separated, the more we're not seeing eye to eye. And that's a real shame because we're missing out on these kinds of friendships and understandings across those kind of divides that seem to be, as we know, getting a little bit more frightening these days.
Yeah. Point where you start hearing this climate denial that the film itself starts to, you sort of use that moment as a device for the film to sort of make this turn to where we start to see how complicated the story is. Now, first, of course, climate change is a factor, no doubt. Climate change is, you know, as you point out, has shifted the environment. It's accelerating, you know, the problem, converting forests to grassland. You work through all of this in the film. But you had made an assumption about climate change and fires, and you say it's an assumption that was only partly right. Talk about that.
Yeah, I wanted to talk to the smartest people I could get a hold of, right, about exactly what was going on, and assumed that climate change was going to be the whole story. And suddenly I was hearing, no, Paradise was going to burn whether or not there was climate change.
Let me play a clip from the film, because as someone tells you, climate change may be a factor in these wildfires, but it's also a distraction. Here's a moment. This is the environmental historian Steve Pine.
I'm tired. I'm sorry to say this in a way, because you get blamed a climate change denier or your soft denier. That's not my intention. But if you say climate change is the only thing that matters, then the only thing to fix it is fixing climate change. That's not going to happen for a long time. I say that with sadness. I've got grandkids. You know, I would like a better world for them. But we don't just have to build concrete bunkers and wait it out. We can work with this.
So when he says we can work with this, talk a little bit about what he means. And what is he saying here? Because this seems to offer a kind of a sense of hope in which is usually a really grim picture when you're talking about climate change.
Yeah, it's good news. As he says, we can do stuff about these fires. So that was the beginning of the turn of the film where I think, okay, well, if he's saying there's stuff we can do, let's find that out, right? Mm-hmm. And off I went.
The film really explores the history of fire in the West. And one of the things you mention is that fire has always been a part of the landscape and an important one. Mm. Now we're going to get back to that part about the indigenous people and their relationship with fire, which was really fascinating. But talk about another element of history, and that is gold and the discovery of gold, how that changes the picture. Not just gold, but material wealth and opportunity, how that really transforms this story.
What was fascinating for me about going on this journey of understanding fire was I uncovered all the history of California and also the learning the landscape, but also the kind of layers of what had happened and understanding that the story was really the story of California, how we got here. I wouldn't go into the history if it wasn't essential to understand what kind of a pickle we are in. And understanding these history of the rushes that had brought people. And actually, if you're in Paradise, it's fascinating because it's a real gold mining town. They found the biggest gold nugget ever in Magalia. Mm. And Magalia is actually the kind of adjacent area of Paradise that also burned. And it's absolutely gold rush central, so to speak, but also logging central. So you have this kind of succession of booms in that area. And everyone you spoke to, actually, their relatives will have come for either the gold rush or the logging rush, or recently because it's affordable housing from the Bay Area. But it's just interesting to see those waves of history, and each of those waves is actually part of the story.
I want to ask about the timber boom. Timber becomes big business, and a few things are going on. First, the timber industry is creating the conditions for bigger and more destructive fires. Mm. But also there's this financial incentive that you explore, you know, this incentive to put them out. And this gets us to the area of fire suppression and this, as you put it, this narrative about fire. Let me play another moment from the film. We're going to hear in this section the geographer and wildlife analyst Zeke Lunder. Also, the environmental historian Steve Pine is here, and Char Miller, he's an environmental scientist.
In 1910, about 3.25 million acres burned, 78 firefighters killed. So they were determined that would never happen again on their watch.
And so starting in 1910, the Forest Service has made it its primary mission to be able to put out wildfire. They developed the 10 a.m. policy that meant that as soon as you had an ignition, the objective was to try to put the fire out before 10 a.m. of the following day. And that is what we call fire suppression.
And then the great housing boom after World War II, suddenly there's a huge demand for timber. You're creating all kinds of slash. You're starting to have fire problems. And so a whole lot more of fire protection was necessary.
So straight through the 20th century, we've been trying to put out as many fires as we could. We've got a narrative that has been built for us by the media that casts the firefighters as heroes and the suppression as this kind of noble combat operation. And fire is always cast as the villain.
Lucy, talk more about that, the idea of, because it seems almost like that is a theme in this film, the idea of fire being cast as a villain. We've come to attack fire with these militaristic strategies, and that makes us feel good, but it's clearly not working.
That's right. It's not working. And one of our characters describes it as a war on nature.
Yeah.
I go on a journey of realizing that fire is going to happen. And if you put out the little fires, you're just kicking that can down the road, because then when the conditions are just right, the fire is going to come along. It's going to be so enormous and there's so much fuel that it's just a matter of time. And then you get an enormous and voracious fire that burns extremely hot and starts to burn even the ultimate fire adapted species. We're seeing giant sequoias dying now in these fires, which is tragic, of course, because these are the iconic, beautiful species of California, the majestic scale of the megaflora of California. And these trees are actually, their seed pods are cued to open by the heat of the fire. It melts the wax and the seed pods open, and then the seed pods fall to the ground, which has been cleared of debris by the little fire burning through. That's how it used to work. But now you get these voracious fires that can actually scorch even to the top of these tall trees and even through this bark that's enormously thick. And I find that absolutely tragic and a real sort of barometer of what's happening and how abnormal it is that even this, you know, these trees that have lived through hundreds of fires are now not surviving the kinds of fire that we're now seeing, because we put out all these small fires thinking that that's the thing to do and not being able to cope with the amount of fuel that's piling up and piling up and piling up. And there isn't anything, there's only so much, you know, so log thinning you can do. And then you think, okay, well, logging, and, you know, kind of intuitively makes sense. Get the trees out of the way, that'll help. And actually that had been the Trump administration's recommendation after these tragic fires. A month later, there was a mandate of increased logging as a solution to the fires. And to start with, you're like, okay, well, that sort of makes sense, right? Get the trees out of the way from paradise, and that surely will help stop things burning, right? Makes sense. Get the wood out of the fireplace, then that'll help. And then I went on a whole other discovery of realizing that actually logging does the opposite of fire in terms of taking care of the forest. Logging is spreading invasive species that are incredibly flammable. Logging is creating all this slash debris, which is kind of like kindling. And then if companies clear cut and plant young plantations, they're unbelievably flammable. I was taken up to the ignition point by several people and got to look at that landscape that the campfire had burned through as it raced towards paradise in an effort to understand why had it moved so fast. This fire moved so much faster than any other fire. And because it moved so fast, as we learn while watching the fire, it was the speed of the fire that gave people no time to escape. The speed of this fire was what killed people. And so understanding how the speed of fire was caused by the type of landscape and the history of what had gone on in that landscape was an absolute revelation. And I haven't seen that really reported elsewhere.
I like how Steve Pine explains. He says, because you sort of, there's forest ecology and then there's fire ecology, and they sort of play against each other. And Steve Pine says in the film that logging and fire do different things. Logging takes the big stuff and leaves the little. Fire burns the little and leaves the big. And that's an important difference.
Exactly. And if you think about a fireplace and you want to get a fire going, you put the kindling on, you put the little stuff. And if you want to, if you put a big chunk of green wood, it's going to put the fire out. And so you start to understand that actually natural forests are more fire resilient than you think. But the unnatural forests, or with the ones with loads of debris or invasive, much more flammable species, and also ladder fuels, which are actually cleaned out by regular little fires. So you sort of start to see that when you put out all the little fires, you're storing up real big trouble. And then when the right day, the right conditions come along, there is nothing these firefighters can do. It's just a losing battle, and people are going to die. And we don't want that to be true, right? We want heroic stories of, we can control this. We've got this, sort of just throw some more firefighters, throw some more equipment at the problem. Surely we can solve this. And actually that had been my assumption. I came over from Europe and I'm looking at the fires and thinking, put those things out. They're scaring me. I don't want the smoke here. And you realize that actually perhaps that exact mindset was what has gotten us into this problem, which was the Europeans that came over here made this assumption that the fires are things you can put out and control and don't need and aren't going to happen anyway. Just get rid of them, control those things, and didn't really understand that that's not how this landscape functions. And we didn't like the Native Americans' burning practices. They'd figured this out about the land, actually, and had very advanced technologies for handling the fact that this landscape was going to burn one way or the other.
One of the people in the film is Trina Cunningham with the Maidu people in the Sierra Nevada mountain region. And she talks about how there are these ancient practices of burning, as you said, and trying to get people to get a sense of understanding, you know, a fire-adapted landscape, as she explains it. She says wildfires that we're experiencing now, she says they're not natural disasters. This is human error.
Mm-hmm.
So talk a little bit about Trina. There's this moment, in fact, let me play a moment where you show Trina doing some burning in the film, some natural burning. Let me play this moment and have you talk about it.
I told my grandpa what I was doing a few years ago, and he said, "Oh, you're trying to do what I was trying to do." And it's generation after generation of tribal knowledge being available, but the larger society not willing to look at that as a viable answer.
So you, as someone who, as you said, came from Europe to the American West, I guess you started seeing your own part in this thinking, the way it wasn't aligning with these native practices. They're thinking of fire in very different ways than you were, than we all are. Yeah.
That's right. Fire is a tool rather than a scary and destructive thing that had no point and value and to be eliminated to save the timber crop and to just be rid of the bother. She has a very different story about fire. It's really fascinating to listen to that. And very sad to hear that, you know, the generations of people have been trying to share this knowledge and nobody wanted to listen.
The film, Lucy, weaves this, you know, this history and science and drama of wildfires into the experience of actually being a firefighter. And I want to talk about the emotional toll that it's taking on them. Let me play another moment from the film. You're going to hear, among others, Maeve Juarez, one of the firefighters, one of the initial firefighters that you were thinking about following in those early days. She talks about, again, the sort of emotional impact of fighting fire.
Firefighting is definitely not for the faint of heart. You're usually going into an incident or a call when someone's having a really, really bad day.
We do see a lot of fatalities, we see a lot of injuries, we see a lot of terrible things in this job.
You really have to get good at compartmentalizing.
How do you not feel like you failed? I mean, it's all on the ground. I'm a firefighter, and this fire just destroyed this town. How do I live with that feeling of, did you do enough?
I could have saved more people, could have saved that house. I could have done more. I could have done more. You question yourself.
So I had a lot of firemen that saw a lot of bad things that day that are questioning whether or not they want to continue their career as firemen.
Yes.
So
a lot of death, a lot of people burn up, yeah. A lot of ugly, yeah. A lot of ugly.
Yes. A lot of regular patients that we went to on a regular basis to help through the past 10, 15, 20 years and going to those homes and finding their remains was probably the worst.
I continually second-guessed myself and thought, could I have done something better? Could I have saved more lives? It's pretty hard to just come home and go to the park and pretend that none of that happened. You still can't help but hold on to some of that guilt.
3 o'clock in the morning, I'm still looking at YouTube videos. So yes, it has affected my sleep. When you roll the incident through your head right before bed, when your brain takes over and starts saying, well, what if the winds went this way that day? What if I could have done that? You know, your rational side has to come in and say, you'd have died if you'd have tried that. Oh, you'd have just killed your crew. I'll be replaying it for a long time.
Why do you think, Lucy, they're second guessing? Is it just that this is what comes with the job, or is part of it our fault in the sense that we don't understand how this works and there's a real sense of frustration? There, I mean, what do you think it is?
I think it's PTSD. I think that they're going through enormously traumatic events, and what we're asking them to go through as these fires get worse is only worse. Mm. And, you know, some of these campaign fires, firefighters are away from home for 30 days at a time. Their shifts are 24 hours. You know, but they don't go home in between because these fires are happening in remote places, you know. So they're stuck out there with the world's most hellish conditions, and their job is trying to help people. And firefighters are the biggest hearted creatures I've ever met. You know, they want to help. They want to help you. And if you want to break a firefighter's heart, ask them what more they could have done, because they always just want to do more. They want to help. They want to save people. They want to save structures. They are completely devoted to that and incredibly beautifully motivated and intentioned. And so it really causes tremendous pain when they can't save the town, can't save lives, can't save everybody. We just ask so much of our first responders. And I think that was something I really wanted to share with the film, was to show how challenging their jobs are and the personal toll that it takes on them.
Lissy Walker, we're talking about her film Bring Your Own Brigade. It's part of the documentary competition at this year's Sundance Film Festival, which got underway last night. We have screening information about the festival on our website, radiowest.org. We'll take another break. Come back in a moment. You're listening to Radio West.
Last year, people took to the streets in cities across the U.S. to protest against police brutality and for racial justice. That conversation is still happening, including here in Utah. I'm Emily Means.
And I'm Sonia Hudson. On this week's 45 Days, we're going to see how state lawmakers are answering the calls from protesters to hold police accountable.
Listen to 45 Days for free wherever you listen to podcasts, or just go to 45days.org.
This is Radio West and Doug Fabrizio. Today in the program, we're beginning our coverage of the Sundance Film Festival. Over the next few episodes, we're going to be profiling some of the films in this all-online festival this year. And we're getting started with Lissy Walker's film, Bring Your Own Brigade. It's about wildfires in the West. She explores the dozens and dozens of decisions made over the last 100 years about wildfire, and she looks at forest ecology and questions and assumptions about fire. And really, she shows the emotional and psychological impact of this wildfire crisis. What do you think you learned about human nature in making this film? Because it seems to me like there were two things that you really dig into. And one is that impulse to cast blame. Mm. And then there's this other impulse for people to want to just go back to living exactly how they were living before and not really learning from the experience of the past. And I kind of wanted to break those in pieces. Let's talk about the blame part first. Because in the film, we see residents who have there's a scene I wanted you to talk about where they've gathered at a Malibu City Council meeting in the wake, in the aftermath of this fire. Mm-hmm. And as one of the people told you, they want to find some blame. They're angry. And they let officials and firefighters there have it. I wanted to get your reaction to some of the firefighters to that idea of blame, because it's really, really, really sad. I mean, they're talking about it being hurtful and disappointing. Mm. Talk a little bit about that part, the blame part.
Oh, yeah, it was fascinating to watch because I had been on the story from the beginning and been in the fires, embedded with the firefighters and the residents, and really understood what had gone on. Then to see how people reacted. And there was a huge amount of criticism of the firefighting, especially in Malibu, of the decisions about where people were deployed. And, you know, some people had experiences where they wanted an engine to help save their house and the engine didn't for various reasons. There were a lot of incredibly upset residents who'd lost their homes and blaming the firefighters. And so when you hear these complaints, but you happen to know because you were there what happened, and there's a lot of tension with people who don't see the same way. Mm. And it was just interesting to be able to talk to the firefighters about what happened and to talk to the residents and also to sit in on these council meetings where people got very angry and were heckling the firefighters. It was fascinating. Yeah,
was it disappointing? I mean, it must have been disappointing.
No, I feel an instinct to defend the firefighters because
but I'm saying the residents that people.
No, I get that they don't understand, and I get that they have, as one of the firefighters point out, that anger, that is a stage of grief.
Yeah.
I totally get it. I totally get that what the residents are going through. And that's the beautiful thing about the way I like to make films, I guess, or the way I see the world is,
yeah.
I always think people are doing the best they can, you know? And where I like to make the films is where people doing the best they can actually can't solve it. And we need to do something different, because right now we're all doing the best we can. The residents are doing the best they can. The firefighters are doing the best they can. The experts are doing the best they can, but we're not getting it together to solve this yet. But I do feel an instinct always to defend the firefighters, because I just can't fathom that people would criticize these people, because the more you know about their jobs, my eyes get wet every single time I think about what I've seen them do. And I know that I haven't scratched the surface of what they do. So I have a bias that I get upset if people criticize firefighters, but I also totally get why people think that it was that. And I think that's something that the film really hopes to explain to people, is it's not about the firefighters not firefighting very well.
Yeah.
You know, that was my assumption too. You know, I thought, what's going wrong? Can't we solve this, throw a few more firefighters at this and maybe better ones or something? You know, I had that assumption too. And I was completely wrong, you know, and that's exactly what the film explains, is it's not about the firefighting. This is a losing battle and it's only going to get worse. And if we don't understand that, we're not going to make good decisions about how to actually not get burned here.
Yeah. Well, it's also, as you say, it's not about the firefighters. It's about the planning that comes before. And all, as someone says in the film, all of the thousands of decisions that came, you know, 100 years ago. I want to ask you about a scene in the film where you show the Paradise City Council meetings, where there's this question, again, in the aftermath of this fire. They're going to consider adopting these building codes to take into account the fire danger. And, you know, are they going to be willing to get rid of roof obstruction like gutters? And are they going to be willing to build a 5-foot fire break? I want to play a moment from the council meeting where the council is going to vote on changing these building codes. And this is what we're hearing from the people of Paradise. People, mind you, who not so long ago had experienced this devastating, fatal fire.
A lot of these things are taking away from the individuality of the town. You're telling me that I can't have bark and some plants and rose plants around my house?
I think I understand now what you want. I was thinking about it. We could all buy a hot water heater and cut a door in it, and we'd have an insulated, fireproof house.
The new homes will already be more fire safe than before. I didn't hear people begging for higher building codes. Please let people return and build the homes they want to build.
A majority of people I have dealt with are underinsured, if insured at all. You have a lot of people who may not be able to come back. That would reduce this town's property tax revenue by a tremendous amount. That would affect your police department, your fire department, and your schools.
Paradise is an individualistic town. That's part of the charm and the quirkiness, and we don't need consistency or uniformity.
So shame on you, and don't price out a large percentage of us Paradise residents who love the Ridge and we want to come home.
We don't need to be some kind of experiment for the rest of the world. Let people come home. If the people come home, y'all are going to go away.
So I'm sure, Lucy, you're going to call on your empathy for these people again. And I get it. I absolutely do. But you also mentioned you were in the front row of these meetings when people who had experienced this terrible thing were not willing to do just basic things to change their building codes or the way they were living their lives. You described it as kind of a civics lesson for you. What were you learning in that experience?
I was learning that it's really hard for people to understand how each of their contributions can add up to a much safer community. And that is the best shot we have at tackling this. It was really interesting just to observe it all. And I felt like I got an understanding into how the world works on a big scale. It's like, you know, or even, you know, that dilemma we have with voting. It's like, well, is my vote really going to make a difference? Because I got better things to do today. The psychology was really fascinating. And these are people who have been through the worst and just want their homes back. And yeah. So you do sympathize. And I think Zeke puts it really well in the film. He says, you know, we have a hesitancy to tell people in crisis, there's a couple of obstacles in your way. But if we don't, what we're really doing is rebuilding a town that is just as fire prone as the one before. And look what happened there. And it's in a very fire prone place. And so it is going to burn. I mean, I couldn't believe when I found out that there hasn't just been one fire in Paradise in the last 20 years. There have been 15. Mm. 15, right? And they're getting more. And since the campfire, there's been another, you know, and it's a problem that's getting worse and worse. You know, as we know, 2020 was the worst year. Or maybe you don't, but 2020 was the worst year. So we're really, it's not a tricky trend to track. You know, we're really on a bad track here. And I was stunned that people who had gone through so much loss and lost 85 people in one day in a town wouldn't do everything that they could.
Yeah.
But no, they didn't want obstacles. And I think there's also something that for me seems like a very American type of a mindset coming from Europe that's very much about liberty. I don't believe in government. I don't want to be told what to do. I want to do things my own way. And that can be a wonderful way to be. And it probably is exactly how all the gold miners came to California. And I talk about how I came as an immigrant alone to California. But as the state sort of fills up and as we face this fire risk, I think what we're learning is going it alone is not going to keep any of us safe. Mm. And it doesn't matter what you do to your house. If your neighbor's house is fire prone, it's going to be a risk factor for your house.
It's like getting vaccinated.
Exactly. It becomes this kind of social contagion. And somebody actually, Steve Pine, makes a beautiful comparison between the virus and the pandemic. And that was actually a really interesting thing for me, was I feel like if I tugged on the issue of fires hard enough and really followed that thread and learned, I kind of came to the same insights as I think we're facing as a culture right now about how do we tackle a bigger problem than us, you know? And whether it's climate change or this virus or the fire problem, and how do we try to come together? And specifically, what are the obstacles? And who pays for the fires is really interesting. And the insurance is a big piece because insurance companies are dropping out of these areas. And there's a lot of sort of really important pieces of the puzzle to understand. But just to see how the whole thing unfolded, and to understand that at one end, you've got residents who are just saying, I need a house. I cannot live in an evacuation center, which we totally get. Who would want that for anybody, right? And on the other hand, you've got the challenging nature of dealing with something new and some associated costs. Some things are free. Like one of the proposals that got voted down was not having gutters except for where you really needed them. And that surprisingly wasn't very popular. And in Malibu as well, for example, where people are more affluent and you'd think it wasn't about cost either, you saw exactly the same thing. And that's why I included that town meeting as well, where there too, they're irate that they can't build faster. And we get it. We want to build faster. Rebuilding seems like the absolute solution to this problem, except for when you understand the problem and you realize that rebuilding things the same way is only going to result in the same problem happening, probably with even more people dying and even more property being lost, which is quite counterintuitive because it seems like a one-time loss, right? And if you don't really get your head around how often this is going to happen and how powerless the first responders are to stop this kind of a fire, then you kind of think it's a one-time problem and we can put that behind us and just rebuild quickly. And that just seems like the way to go, but it's not. And again, because we sort of started with the fire and followed the stories through and followed the different people through, you could really see it all unfold in slow motion and understand all the mechanics of how exactly we're in this mess and how we're going to have to get out of it, frankly.
You know, this made me think of your film, your short film, The Tsunami and the Cherry Blossom, where, for those who don't know, this was a film you made that followed the aftermath of the earthquake and the tsunami in Japan in 2011. And what you do is you focus on the cherry blossom season as this kind of idea of hope for those who had survived and how they were thinking about moving forward. And I'm wondering, how do you compare what happened in Japan in 2011 and the aftermath there and what you were seeing in Paradise or even in Malibu, the people, how they were all reacting and trying to rebuild?
I am somebody that tends to see natural cycles in things. Huh. And something that was fascinating, again, the privilege of being able to follow this story for a little bit of a longer time, was that you get to see people being so knocked down and then being able to follow them through the next stages and follow through. And in some of the more intimate personal stories we follow, like Brad, incredible things unfolded in his life that we're able to track and seem like the kind of human manifestations of green shoots and new life and new love. And it's beautiful to watch that life actually does come back after the fire, and you get the wildflowers, but you kind of get the wildflowers of the spirit as well. You know, you see some people able to bounce back, and that's beautiful. And I think that journey of the natural cycle is something that I fascinated to document and to find in our world. I think it's a beautiful rhythm of the universe that we, you know, go through these cycles of suffering and able to heal. And that's a story that I can never get enough of, I suppose. But I think there's a lot more to this film. You know, this is a much longer and more complicated film. In the stories, I think, get really into something that isn't quite a natural disaster. I mean, as Trina says, this is a human error. It's not natural. And there are things that we can do, and there are things to understand. Whereas a tsunami is really the definition of sort of out of control, isn't it? And nothing we can do about that apart from not build in tsunami zones. But in both films, there were some beautiful instances of that resilience spirit that is possible even among such tragedy, to find some green shoots, not to take away from the tragedy, but the fact that we can, as humans, pick back up, and life is good, you know, as Brad says at the end of the movie, you know, life is really good. And that's something that I think both films do get to. And I personally am very happy to find, because don't we all need that, especially perhaps right now?
Yeah. Let me ask you finally, you say in the film the experience profoundly affected how you feel about this place that you now call home here in the United States. In what way do you think, how do you feel profoundly affected now about, and how do you think about home differently?
Ah, every way. Trina, again, has a beautiful line about how when you start listening to the landscape around you, it starts speaking to you in a different way. And I really feel that. I really feel like, I'm not like in a Europe that's a bit sunnier, you know? I'm in a completely different place. And now I understand that. And I have a relationship with this place and a relationship with fire. I understand that it's as natural as breathing. It kind of is the plants breathing. And it's the same chemical process as breathing, actually. It's going to happen in this landscape. And it's just about how we live with that. And also understand the layers of history and understand that my role as a European in this landscape and what that is to be kind of an invasive species, frankly, you know, and to think about the land that I'm standing on and the indigenous people that lived here before I did, and to engage with the layers of history and to think of myself as one more of these people that came for the rush. In my case, it was the movie industry. And to understand that my part in that and how I can perhaps be more in touch with the landscape and the people and the history, and to think about how I build community and how I came alone, but I want to make sure that we're working together, because I don't think we'll survive otherwise.
Lucy Walker, thank you very much.
Thank you.
Lucy Walker's film is Bring Your Own Brigade. It's part of this year's Sundance Film Festival. You can get information about how to see it and others at Sundance on our website, radiowest.org. Radio West is a production of KUER. You can subscribe to the show wherever you get your podcasts. And as always, we'd love to hear from you. We're on Twitter at Radio West. Our intern is Aaron Camargo, the program produced by Benjamin Bombard and Tim Slover. Christy Miners is our executive producer. I'm Beck Fabrizio. Thank you.